From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Have you ever wondered if the rich are really all that different from the rest of us? Well, Richard Conniff thinks so. Conniff has discovered that the rich have a lot in common with exotic creatures like baboons and Arabian babblers. In fact, Conniff has learned that when rich people wear animal print clothes, it gives new meaning to the phrase, dressed to kill.
When somebody comes out and has lots of tiger stripe, lots of crocodile skin, snake skins, various things like that, you know, that's evoking a predator response in us and intimidating us a little bit.
On today's program, we'll explore the wild kingdom of the wealthy. And not to worry, no rich people will be harmed in the making of this show. And we'll find out why so many of us are in the middle of a torrid love affair with luxury. Also, ever wondered what the Brannock device is? Well, probably not, because you probably never even heard of it, but chances are very good that you've come into close contact with the Brannock device. But first, middle-class America. It's pretty much ceased to exist. It's the argument that Paul Krugman makes in a recent cover story for the New York Times Magazine. Krugman's article is called For Richer. It says, we're in the midst of a modern-day plutocracy, in which a very small fraction of the population controls a very large amount of the wealth. The 13,000 richest families in America now have almost as much income as the 20 million poorest families. And those 13,000 super-rich families have incomes that are 300 times those of average families. Paul Krugman told Steve Paulson how this growing gap between the rich and the middle class became a chasm.
Like a growing number of people who work on this stuff, I've been driven to the view that what we're really looking at is a social change rather than a narrowly economic phenomenon. It's not like the rising price of oceanfront property. It's more like a change in mores, a change in social norms.
It's become acceptable to be very rich? That's no longer something you have to be kind of embarrassed about?
It's become acceptable to use your insider position to make yourself very rich. So if you actually look at where the really big gains have been, the most spectacular has been corporate CEOs. A quite large part of this increase is people who are either CEOs or one way or another in a kind of insider position in large organizations, especially corporations. For a long time, from Franklin Roosevelt up through the 1970s, people were inhibited about doing that. They feared that there would be some kind of retribution. They would be outraged. If you were a corporate CEO and you walked off with $500 million while your workers lost their shirts, that you would be in trouble. The outrage is gone. It's become okay. And if you look, I think the best story we have, the one that fits the facts most effectively, is one which says that we really are talking about a situation where people who know the right people, who have the right connections and have their hands on the levers of power, both in the private and the public sector, now feel that it's okay to go for it and take whatever they can.
But how did that happen? Why did it become okay to flaunt your wealth, to demand it?
I think you want to look at a bunch of things coming together and all reinforcing each other. The labor movement has been in decline over a fairly long period. That means that one of the major parties that could have said, hey, wait a minute, doesn't have the ability to do that anymore. We've had a change in the political spectrum, which is partly disillusionment. There were a lot of troubles in the 70s, and people had less trust in government and less trust in people who wanted more equality. You had a very cunning, very well-financed campaign on the part of right-wing foundations that disseminated essentially pro-wealthy ideas in our society. And maybe just the memory of the Depression and the New Deal gradually faded. I mean, I think is that the relatively decent middle-class society we had for about 30 years after World War II was in some sense not the natural state of America. It's something that was created in a great moment of national crisis, and people forgot about those ideals.
Now, I think one of the traditional ways of thinking about wealth is that there will always be very rich people in America. That's the nature of capitalism. But everyone benefits. I mean, the wealth kind of filters down and middle-class people won't be as wealthy, of course, but they'll benefit too.
And I have no objection to a distribution of income like the one we had in 1970. I don't think there's anything wrong with a society in which the top 1% have 8% of total income and which the top 0.01% have 0.5% of total income.
But is there any evidence that the more people at the top have, actually, that leaves less for people down below?
If you look at what happened to middle-class living standards during the post-war generation, they rose dramatically. you look at what happened to them in the second post-war generation, which is basically where we are now, during which inequality has increased dramatically, you discover that there's at best an iffy improvement in the living standards of the middle class. Most families are not noticeably better off than their counterparts were 30 years ago. If you look internationally, the United States has a much greater concentration of income at the top than any other advanced nation. It's also the richest advanced nation. And if you want to be a defender of our system, you say, well, those are connected. It turns out that if you look at a whole bunch of social indicators that tell you how well people are doing in general, the United States is not number one. We have lower life expectancy, higher infant mortality, more people who are functionally illiterate. You go down the list and you discover that we are, it's good to be rich in America, better than any place else. To be working class in America is in many ways not particularly good compared with the way it is even in Canada.
So you're talking about not just income, but lifestyle and the various factors that go into quality of life, health care, that kind of thing.
A lot of it is just plain income. Let's be clear. If you say that infant mortality is much lower in European countries than it is in the United States, it's worth remembering that when you get down to the bottom 20% or so of the distribution, the people in Europe have got a lot more income, just plain purchasing power, than people in the bottom 20% in the United States, even though those are poorer countries than ourselves. And yes, then there are also questions of social services, of health care. I don't want to go overboard and say that, you know, we are a terrible society, but there's this widespread belief in America that we must be the best in everything. And if we have rich people, that's okay because their enterprise pulls up the standard of living of everybody else, and that's why we have better everything than anyone else in the world. But it ain't so. We have a middle class that really is not dramatically better off than its counterparts in other countries, and we have poor who are substantially poorer than their counterparts in other countries.
I think that the typical thinking is that the average American family is still better off than the average family from Sweden or Italy or England.
That is not obviously true. I mean, it's not a slam dunk either way. The average American family has a bigger house, is more likely to have two cars, but it has much less vacation time and is much more vulnerable to misfortune. If the main breadwinner should lose his job, the American family finds itself without health insurance, for example. So that if you ask, you know, would you prefer, if you knew all the facts, and you could somehow choose, would you prefer to be a person dead in the center of the income distribution in the United States or in Sweden? I think that many people would at least hesitate. In a lot of ways, it might be better, certainly safer, to be in that position in Sweden.
What are the political implications of this growing gap between rich and poor?
Well, there's a fact about American politics. I think it becomes increasingly obvious, but it's something that you can actually measure. Our political system is really pulling apart. There is no middle in American politics anymore, at least when it comes to elected representatives. Now, there used to be a kind of center of Republicans and Democrats who were not that distinguishable from each other and provided a kind of balance, preventing extreme policies in either direction. It's gone. The parties are further apart than they've been since the 1920s. And what they're divided on is economics. The Democrats have become the party that still sort of wants to tax the rich and give something to the poor, and the Republicans have become the party that wants to do neither.
But earlier you said the real reason that CEO salaries have skyrocketed, that basically we have more, maybe not more, but we have greater levels of super wealth, is a change in social mores, that it has become all right, it's become acceptable to be very rich and to show it. And I guess I wonder how you deal with that.
Well, I think we have reached a point now where the public is at least ready to say, okay, that's enough. Not maybe to roll it back to where it was 30 years ago, but ready to say that's enough. It seems to me that there's an interesting clue here. If you look at the differences between the way the Reagan tax cut was sold and the Bush tax cut was sold. The Reagan tax cut and Bush tax cut were both very, very heavily tilted towards the top. Reagan was quite frank about that. He said, well, you know, this is what you need to do. We need to increase incentives. We need to reduce marginal tax rates. And if that means big tax cuts for people at the top, so be it. Bush sold a tax cut that did the same thing, but pretended throughout that it was actually a middle-class tax cut. There was none of this talk about incentives, none of this talk about why it's okay to give a disproportionate share of the tax cut to the rich. They simply denied with the aid of a sloppy media, denied the actual content of their own policy. On the one hand, it's infuriating that, hypocrisy flourishes. On the other hand, the fact that they need to resort to hypocrisy and deception tells you that their judgment is that the American people are not prepared to support more of this. I think we've probably have reached the point where with honest reporting and public education, people are prepared to say this is really not a trend we want to see continue.
Paul Krugman is the author of For Richer, an article that appeared in the New York Times Magazine. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
This song is dedicated to all you modern-day troubadours out there, and I think I know who you are. I gotta get a job, I got to get some pay. My son's gotta go to art school, he's leaving in 3 days. And the TV's in Esperanto, you know that that's a bitch. But alienation's for the rich, and I'm feeling a poorer every day.
Richard Conniff is a journalist. He's been writing about the natural world and rich people for several years. Conniff noticed that the wealthy and members of the animal kingdom have a lot in common. So much in common that Conniff wrote a book called The Natural History of the Rich, a field guide. Richard Conniff told Anne Strainchamps about one of the similar behaviors he's noticed.
The air kiss, to take a small example, there's this tendency to think that the rich and fashionable are doing something terribly modern and affected when they pooch out their mouths and part their lips with that clicking sound and say mwah, mwah, into one another's ears. But in fact, primatologists call this lip smacking, and monkeys and apes do it all the time. It's an appeasement gesture. It's actually a sort of ritualized form of grooming where you reach in with your mouth and you pick insects and dirt out of the other individual's hair. And so when you make this lip smacking, it says, I want to groom you, I want to be your friend. And when we air kiss, we say basically the same thing.
You could say this about almost all humans. I mean, we all have behaviors like this that primatologists or, you know, biologists could recognize. Why did you pick the rich?
Well, the rich are really different in a few ways. They're clearly not genetically different. They behave in a lot of the same ways that we do. But they separate themselves from the rest of society. They go off to isolated places, and they go to places where they will see only one another. And then they begin to behave like one another. So I call them a cultural subspecies. And it just seemed to me that it was worth exploring what those behaviors were.
Do they have different behaviors than, I don't know, the rest of us, the middle class?
They have, for instance, let's just say this. No, dominance behavior is not different. You see dominance behavior at all class levels, but it makes a lot more difference. Let's say a middle manager can storm around and yell at people, but when Bill Gates does it or when Larry Ellison does it, it affects people. People make money, people get jobs, lose jobs. So I thought that that merited a kind of special attention.
So when you first set out, you must have had to answer the first question any biologist would have to answer: how do you even identify this subspecies?
Yeah, I had to identify the rich. And the trouble is that what's rich varies drastically from one place to another. So, you know, somebody with $15,000 a year in income could be rich in a place like Bhutan, but somebody with $15 million wouldn't be rich in Palm Beach or Aspen.
Would not even be rich?
No, you'd be pretty small potatoes in those places. The way I defined rich is basically the same way that banks define it and university fundraisers. They start to pay attention when somebody has about $7 million worth of loose change, investable assets. And that's when things start to get different and people start to behave in these specialized kind of ways.
Are rich people aware of each other's wealth? Do they care? Do they people according to how much money they have?
Absolutely. When somebody walks into a room at let's say, the Four Seasons in New York, everybody knows who's worth what and who's up and who's down. They're incredibly sensitive to that. I mean, one of the reasons that they go off and isolate themselves in these little communities is so that they can compare themselves to others and, you know, be up or be down and have a little, like a, you know, the same sort of social hierarchy that you would have in a baboon troop, but they have it among this small cluster of people who are extremely rich.
And so then what you do is compare this partly to other animal behaviors in the natural world. So can you play that out? I mean, how does this particular intense consciousness of status and each other's wealth compare to the animal world?
I was at the Four Seasons just last week for lunch. In one corner of the room, there were four people. They're at separate tables, but I recognized them, and I happened to know that Their net worth was about $6 billion. It was a nice little chunk of change. And one of them was Ron Perelman. And nothing much happened for most of the lunch. But then at the end, he stood up and he went around the room chucking people on the elbow, patting them on the back. And so these were kind of appeasement gestures. They were like grooming gestures, like the air kiss that say, you know, I'm your friend, I'm not going to hurt you. But then at the same time, he put his hands on his waist and he pulled his jacket back to sort of show off this full belly and his chest puffed up. And he sort of made this promenade down the entire length of the room that was just pure sort of masculine display behavior, saying, you know, I've got it and you all know it and I'm here for you to acknowledge it. That was just a great piece of animal behavior.
So what animals would you see the same thing in?
Well, he reminds me of the ruffed grouse, and that's just a comparison because these ruffed grouse make this, they puff up their chests that way and they fan out their tails and then they drum their wings with this incredible drumming that, well, it's very impressive. And he was very impressive too.
I would imagine once you start looking at display behaviors and thinking of wealthy behaviors as forms of display behavior, there just would be no end to the comparisons you could make.
Yeah. What interested me about display behavior was we all have this notion that what counts is conspicuous consumption. And so you think that the guy who puts on the really splashy show is the one that has the most status. But in fact, it doesn't work that way. I quote an entertainment industry lawyer at one point, and the first thing he did when he got rich was buy a Rolls Royce, and he drove it around, and he was really proud of it. And then David Geffen, the producer, said to him, you know, would you please get rid of that Rolls Royce? You know, you just don't need it anymore. And he realized that it was nouveau riche, that this conspicuous consumption, in fact, was the wrong way to display your status, and that you have to do it in ways that are more subtle, what I call inconspicuous consumption.
And is there an equivalent in the animal kingdom?
Yeah. You think that a peacock and its tail is all about big, splashy, conspicuous display. Again, that's just sort of what gets you in the door. That's what females sort of expect, and that's how they judge you. But then they look much more closely at the minute little details of how you're displaying. And let's say a peacock has 150 feathers. If as few as five of them are out of place or they're, you know, not glossy enough, and they're not, then the females sort of walk away and go to another male's dancing court. And so you have to have this kind of depth in your display for it to be very convincing.
You also have an interesting theory about why some rich people like to wear clothing with animal patterns, you know, tiger stripes, leopard spots.
Yeah. Well, there have been these studies where they have taken populations of monkeys that have been isolated from tigers or leopards for hundreds of years. In one case, they're living in the Caribbean. So, you know, there's no possibility that they have a cultural knowledge that these are dangerous predators. And then they show them a leopard print or a tiger print. And the monkeys just go berserk. They flip out because they have an innate predator response to this color pattern. And humans have been living with predators, particularly leopards, for millions of years. There's a pre-human skull in a museum in South Africa that has a perfect leopard bite right in the skull. It's obviously killed by an attack. So I think we have these same kind of alarms. And so when somebody comes out and has lots of tiger stripe, lots of crocodile skin, snake skins, various things like that, you know, that's evoking a predator response in us and intimidating us a little bit.
You quote a lot of people who've made a fair amount of money, especially people like Jeff Bezos, head of Amazon.com, and other people who made a lot of money in the whole dot-com rise. And a lot of them say things like, I'm really not any different. It's not about the money. I'm the same as I always was. You know, the rich are no different from everybody else. What do you think?
They also said, you know, I just want to be middle class. And then they became middle class to their horror when the whole thing fell apart. Well, you know, your money makes you different whether you want to be different or not because everybody else knows about it and they look at you differently. When your net worth like Bezos is suddenly equal to the gross national product of Iceland, it's kind of hard to chat up the neighbors and, you know, talk about getting the 5-year-old Volvo fixed or whatever it is. So they tend to move into neighborhoods where there are other people like themselves, and it's a way to become normal, actually. But in fact, it separates themselves from the rest of the population. So you become different whether you want to or not, I think.
In fact, didn't you talk to some people who sort of had, you know, told you basically how awful it is to be really wealthy?
Yeah, they talk about, oh, the imbalance in the marriage. They talk about betrayal by friends. They talk about their own sort of unrealistic expectations, you know, because let's say granddad or great-granddad was John D. Rockefeller. Well, you know, what can you possibly do to make your life important or significant? So there are a lot of burdens on the rich.
And at the same time, they're not allowed to complain about it because, you know, how can you complain if you're worth several billion?
Absolutely. You're expected to basically shut up. But nobody is going to be sympathetic with any of this, so I don't mean to play the violin here. We still envy them, and they still have the money, but it's not as easy as it may seem.
Richard Conniff is the author of The Natural History of the Rich, a field guide. He spoke with N. Strange Champs.
I've got 90,000 pounds in my pajamas. I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge. I've got lots of lovely lira. Now the Deutsche Mark's getting dearer, and my dollar bills would buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing like a newly minted pound. Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that wakes the world around. You can keep your Marxist ways, but it's only just a phrase. For it's money, money, money makes the world.
We don't know the same political stories, that's for sure, and we certainly don't know the same religious stories, but we do know the same stories that hang on objects. And that's what we have as kind of a lingua franca of modern life.
Coming up, Living It Up, our love affair with luxury. And later, the flip side of luxury, gleaning. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. These days, it seems the purchase of luxury items has become a necessity. Sounds like something Yogi Berra might have said. But consider this. Over the past several years, luxury spending in the United States has been growing 4 times faster than overall spending. It seems we just can't live without our Evian bottled water and Prada sunglasses. James Twitchell is the author of Living It Up, Our Love Affair with Luxury. Twitchell agrees that now, for the first time in history, it's possible for the ordinary person to achieve luxury.
Exactly. Now, you may not be able to achieve it for long. In other words, I can't afford a yacht, but I can take a cruise. I can't afford to go to Bermuda for 3 months, but I can go for the weekend. I can't afford a Lexus, but I can rent one. Very little can be had by the rich that the middle class can't touch. And that is the phenomenon that I find so intriguing.
Now, how did this happen?
Well, it happened because marketers, advertisers, realized in the middle part of the 20th century that the real profit in selling objects was forget the object and sell the story. So that they essentially said, listen, since all the machines produce the same stuff, if we really want to maximize our return, we'll spend our money not on the machine, but on telling stories about the objects. And it's those stories and that phenomenon that, whether we like it or not, is currently shrinking the world, because those stories travel at the speed of television, at the speed of light, and someone getting into their Lexus in Tokyo or someone getting into their Lexus in Madison, Wisconsin or in London knows the same story. We don't know the same political stories, that's for sure, and we certainly don't know the same religious stories, but we do know the same stories that hang on objects. And that's what we have as kind of a lingua franca of modern life.
Isn't that interesting in a lot of ways, that, that marketing should be the one thing? Now, if marketing were so successful, then it ought to be possible to market those other areas of life, wouldn't it?
What do you think Charlotte Beers, one-time CEO of Ogilvy & Mather, is doing in the State Department? I mean, essentially, that's right. And I suppose, ultimately, we will find that, well, we see it already, that nonprofits like schools, churches, museums, and even governments, it's already happened, will adopt the techniques of marketing as a way of generating a brand story that separates this school from that school, even though we know they're very similar, or this church from that church, or this culture from that culture.
You're beginning to frighten me, and we're moving away from the thing that I think we started talking about. It's a fascinating subject, though. Coming back to luxury items, which is the subject of your book, Living It Up, is there a defining moment in American commercial culture that captures our obsession with luxury?
Because I'm an English professor, I guess I always look to literature as sort of the repository of time. For me, in the 20th century, it's a fictional moment when, in The Great Gatsby, Miss Buchanan opens the world of luxury as Gatsby's shirts come pouring out of his closet, and she bursts into tears.
"Such beautiful shirts," she sobbed, her voice muffled in the thick folds. "It makes me sad, because I've never seen such beautiful shirts before."
And to me, that moment, the moment when you see something that is so transcendentally exciting and passionate, because that's what luxury is. Luxury is passion. It's real, almost religious. I hate to sound sacrilegious here, but it's almost religious. It's almost a sense of, epiphany. So that's what a shirt really looks like, or so that's the end of some consuming activity. But it's really been the 1970s and 1980s when this sensation is something that's had by someone in Kmart who's getting close to Martha Stewart, or someone at Target who's buying something by Michael Graves. I mean, this edge is now being moved in Walmart. Well, Sam's Club is probably even a better example. Go into Sam's Club or Costco, and what you'll see are essentially yesterday's luxury objects stacked to the ceiling.
Now, you went to Las Vegas to explore the modern luxury casinos, but I would think you can't tell any difference between the casinos. Or can you?
Yes, you can. I mean, the others have some sort of a rinky-dinky story, like one has sort of King Arthur story, one is Treasure Island story, one is the South Sea story. But the Bellagio and the Venetian are selling the stories of high Renaissance luxury, which is indeed where our view of luxury really starts. It starts visually in the Renaissance with what we now call art, but which in a way was luxurious images inside churches, closer to advertising than what we call art. And that's what these casinos have done, especially the Venetian. They have mimicked with incredible precision the glory and luxury of the imagery of Venice. Then there's a great deal of luxurification of your room, especially for me, the bathroom, a lot of marble on the floor. And of course, it's all based on the idea that if you can move someone into that sensation of luxury, where you're feeling that sense of epiphany and arrival, that will sufficiently lubricate your superego to relax and let you go downstairs and act like an idiot and namely lose your money. So there's an intimate connection, I think, between that feeling of luxury, which is really to feel confident that you've come to the end of the consumer's road, and dropping you down into the cellar where essentially you'll be fleeced.
Is there any sense in which you think that it can be justified on the part of the person who goes there? Can they say legitimately that they have purchased for themselves, through the loss of this money, an experience that will satisfy them?
Well, I'm going to burn in hell for what I'm about to say. But to me, this sequence of sensations, in some dreamy way, has certain overtones of church life, that you go into the church, you feel this sense of purpose, of order, that you are saved, that you're special, that things make sense, and there's a transaction where you're being given this, and in exchange you give your concentration, or ultimately, I suppose, your money, your dues, your tithing, whatever. And in a strange way, that is a mimic of what happens in the Vegas casino. You go in, you feel this transformation. The transformation makes you respond to a series of things that, when you're logical, you might refuse to believe in. And you get that strange, redemptive sensation.
So it's almost a religious experience going to these places.
I think it is. I think, although it's heresy to say it, I think that's one of the pulls of luxury, that it sort of tempts you to think of rebirth, of starting again, of being special, of finding it.
Do you think people are aware of that when they go in?
Oh, God, no. I hope not. No, I think, you know, people who go there are not the people who I thought went there. I was amazed. It was a great hoi polloi that was going to Vegas. I mean, people wearing slingshot T-shirts and just people like normal types that just want to go to Vegas. And when I would ask them, why did you come here? If you want to gamble, why don't you just go, out to an Indian reservation? Or why don't you go to Atlantic City? Or why do you come here into the middle of the absolute end of life? It's out in the desert. There's nothing near it. It's only Vegas. And they said, well, it's a pilgrimage. And I kept thinking to myself, wow, this is a dim mimic of, you know, what in the Middle Ages was a major rite of passage, that you did indeed take a trip and you went to this place and it was at the edge of the world and you did something there and then you went home.
After all the study you've done of it now, is it a good thing, a bad thing? Is it just another thing that is?
On one hand, it's a terrible thing. It's wasteful. The externalities of it are terrible. It generates huge amounts of pollution. Ugh, it's unfair. Certain people have too much of it. Okay, we'll continue that paragraph later. You all know that. On the other hand, I think it's kind of okay. In the first place, if you look back at what life has been like because of luxuries, you can see that to a great degree, almost every object that has made our life easier has come in and been hectored as luxury. I mean, the medium that we're on now, the radio, in the 1930s, unnecessary, don't need it. Air conditioning, unnecessary, don't need it. Indoor plumbing, unnecessary, a luxury, don't need it. Limb replacements, unnecessary, don't need it. Telephone, for sure. Well, maybe in that case, they're right. But almost every technical innovation comes in, twirls around for a while in the world of luxury, and then gets moved into the world of needs. Now, if you don't have indoor plumbing, we say, oh, you are deprived. You don't have basic human needs. Beginning of 19th century, forget it. Unnecessary.
James Twitchell is the author of Living It Up, Our Love Affair with Luxury.
Well, baby, what I couldn't do with plenty of money and you, in spite of the worry that money brings, just a little filthy lucre buys a lot of things. And I could take you to places that you would like to go, but outside of that I've no use for dough. It's the root of all evil, of strife and upheaval. But I'm certain, honey, that life would be sunny with plenty.
Agnès Varda is a French filmmaker. She's made both features and documentaries. Her latest is called The Gleaners and I. The Gleaners and I is a portrait of modern-day gleaners, hungry people who live on the leftovers that the rest of us throw away. These gleaners are people who don't have the basics, like food and shelter, never mind luxury items. Varda told Steve Paulson it's become very easy for people to throw away things that other people could really use.
Some people need the potatoes, need the food, need everything. So I became very touched by the subject, not starting with the little emotion of some people. And then it touched the big problems of overproduction, overwaste, you know, bad distribution all over the world between rich countries and poor countries. And France is not a poor country, but we have poor people, a lot of poor people that have to eat from what they can find. And I was impressed by the fact that when I started the film, I felt myself as a gleaner, picking images, picking stories, meeting faces.
And I suppose especially as a documentary filmmaker, that really is kind of an act of gleaning.
So I thought, even though I didn't want to compare myself with poor people, but I know also artists, they pick things in the street, they make sculpture or painting out of it, you know. So I really got to expand the first subject that I had started, with very various direction.
Well, until I saw your film, I had never really associated the gleaners who live out in the countryside, for instance, those people who would be picking through the dumped potatoes or scouring the ground for fallen apples, and then to think about the scavengers in cities who pick through dumpsters or garbage, the trash pickers, and you're saying that they're really kind of doing the same kind of thing.
They pick what other people have left abandoned. And there is a law about, you know, property. I think it's the same law here. If it's in abandoned somewhere and you touch it and you take it, you become the owner. If it's abandoned. You know, the idea is that you come after people who were the owners. If they have finished picking or they throw things, from that moment, you can come and become the owner. It's a very interesting law.
You have some very poignant interviews with people who are in your film. For instance, there's a man who had been a truck driver and he lost his job. His wife left him. She took their three kids away. And I mean, he's really left with nothing. And he's there living in a little
trailer.
And yet he has dignity. The way you've portrayed him in the film, he doesn't come across as a loser. He comes across as someone who's
had survivor.
He's had some very bad luck in his life.
Yes, but they fight for life. They fight for surviving. And when he said that he goes in garbage, I love the way at the end he says, well, your hands, you can wash them. Like, you know, there is nothing wrong in picking into a garbage can as long as you can wash your hands. Other people in my film, and in the second one too, they show so much intelligence, and they really understand the situation. They speak clearly about what it's all about. They don't have to be, you know, themselves like leftover. What you call dignity is also, it's not so much pride, but self-intelligence. And we are not used to decide that poor people speak intelligently or suburban people or low work workers, you know. And what I really work in my documentaries is to make clear that they have as much possibility of understanding the situation than you and me. The difference, and they have nothing. They don't eat, they have nothing to warm themselves. They live in terrible trailers with no heat, and they tell how difficult their life. But they think, and they think clearly. And that was a point to make clear in my film.
Well, and then there's another man in your film who clearly sees this lifestyle, this way of life, as a political act. He says that he lives on almost 100% of picked trash, and he's been doing it for 10 or 15 years. He's never gotten sick. He's careful about what he eats.
And he loves the birds. He said all these catastrophes with oil, you know, spoiling the ocean, spoiling the fishes, spoiling, killing the birds, is a scandal. And this is right, all this movement now about not only ecology, but trying to save the planet to make it big. This is part of all this, you know. And by touching a very small, very modest, very small subject, I would say, it opens to so many thoughts.
Now, it seems to me you're doing something very complicated with this film because, on the one hand, we've been talking about how some of these people have to pick through the trash to live. I mean, that's where they're going to get their food. But there are other people who see beauty in the trash, who see an object on the street that's out by the roadside, it's going to be thrown out, and they think it's gorgeous. And some of these people turn it into art. And you're really raising the question of what is beautiful? What is art?
Well, just not decide what is good and bad to start with. Like, there was a scene in the film, I come home and my ceiling is totally rotten because there was a leak, something. And people say, oh, you have to fix it right away. I say, well, it looks quite good to me. It looks like an abstract painting. If we put our mind not to decide to start with what is good, what is bad, I enjoyed my ceiling totally rotten. It was beautiful to look at. Then it became too wet. I had to fix it. What I'm saying is that beauty is where you don't expect it to be. We shouldn't be just square about this is art, this is poor and stupid, this is good and good. And so I'm trying to just leave myself totally ready to trying to understand what's around me and share it with other people, because it's always a question of sharing. You know, I make a film so that people in the audience will meet the people I've been filming and discuss in between themselves what they think about gleaning, just saying that a film can be a mind opener in a way. And I had my mind opened by the situation and the film.
You have some interviews with wonderful artists, people who have scavenged to find various objects that were being thrown out and have turned them into collages or all kinds of artwork, big sculptures. There's one man who builds sculptures out of dolls, or there are dolls that are part of it.
He's a real wild artist. He used to be a mason. Huh. And when he retired, he went to the garbage and he's hooked on dolls and he piled them up like totem, like, I don't know, like big towers. You know, there are many wild artists. They wouldn't be recognized in museums or galleries, but they do their thing. And I like to approach those out-of-the-way people. The people are not in format as the potatoes. Those interest me more than the classical person doing fine and, you know.
You're drawn to the outsiders, whether they're the outsider yeah. artists or the outsiders of to mainstream society.
Absolutely, because the insider are sometimes so heavy, so classical, so they don't see the world, you know, they just go their way, which is okay. But I'm interested in other people. And myself, I consider myself as a filmmaker, slightly on the side.
Agnes Varda is a filmmaker. Her latest documentary is called The Gleaners and I. She spoke with Steve Paulson. You could call Matthew Herbert an audio gleaner. When he performs as Radio Boy, he makes music with things like McDonald's paper bags and plastic Frappuccino cups from Starbucks. Herbert digitally manipulates the sounds to create music that protests global consumerism. Here's Starbucks from his CD, The Mechanics of Destruction. Coming up, the Brannock device, animal crackers, and strange flavors of lifesavers from down under. Paul Lucas will introduce us to the world of inconspicuous consumption. Products that we take for granted. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Lucas spends a lot of time thinking about stuff that most of us take for granted. As a matter of fact, Lucas has written a book called Inconspicuous Consumption, an obsessive look at the stuff we take for granted. What is inconspicuous consumption? Well, Lucas says that it's all about paying attention to the details of consumer culture. For example,
the classic example and the item that sort of got me started going down this road is the Brannock device, which is the gizmo they use at the shoe store to measure your shoe size. Now, everybody knows what the Brannock device is. There's literally nobody listening to us right now whose foot has not been in a Brannock device. But at the same time, almost nobody knows what it's called.
I didn't even know it had a name.
Yeah, they just think of it as that shoe gizmo or the foot measuring gadget or whatever. So everybody knows what it is, but nobody knows the story behind it or even what it's called. So it's sort of classically, quintessentially inconspicuous. It hides in plain sight. And it's called the Brannock device after its creator, Charles Brannock, who invented it back around 1920. and it's sort of become the standard. It's essentially brought the shoe measuring world to its knees. It demolished every other similar product on the market because it's sort of a perfect example of what it was meant to be. It has extreme functional specificity. It's only meant to do one thing, but it does it extremely well. It's had almost no design modifications since its invention, and it's really an example of perfection. Despite all these wonderful hallmarks to its design and the fact that we've all encountered it and we've all had our foot in it, nobody knows what it's called except, you know, people who work in shoe stores and such. And therefore, this is the prototypical example, if you will, of inconspicuous consumption.
Well, you're right. I mean, also, once you do begin to look at it, you think what a beautiful device it is.
In fact, it's a gorgeous design. The chrome and black, it's got one sliding piece that moves back and forth, another sliding piece that moves up and down. I'm looking at my own Brannock device now.
You own a Brannock device?
I keep one in my office just for inspiration, you know, just as a reminder that the world is full of really cool things if we just pay attention to them. And, you know, when I mention the Brannock device to people, I can almost see the light bulb going on over their heads, and I bet our listeners are having the light bulbs going on over their heads right now. This sense of realization and discovery, the sense of, yeah, that is a really cool thing. I just never really thought about it before. Because the Brannock device is, in fact, a universal touchstone in our culture. Literally everybody has encountered it. And for the most part, we encounter it when we're children, when our feet are still growing. So those are very primal memories and usually pretty happy memories. It means we can get a new pair of sneakers or, you know, a new pair of shoes. And once we know our shoe size, and, you know, we become adults and our shoe size stays constant, we don't need the Brannock device anymore. But they still have them at the shoe store. And if you go in and they say, you know, what's your size? And if you say, well, you tell me, they'll pull out a Brannock device and you can relive those nostalgic days of youth.
You've reviewed quite a number of things. One of them that I confess that I bought a lot of over the years is Barnum's Animal Crackers. What do you find so interesting about them, though? I mean, they're just crackers, aren't they?
Yeah, but it's a particularly delightful product. You know, there's something nice about the animal shapes. You know, even a vegetarian will eat an animal if it's an animal cracker. But what's really particularly nice about the animal cracker package and the whole animal cracker experience is the little white cloth string that they put on the box. And when you think of all the cutting of corners and streamlining of designs and so forth, all the ways to cut costs in today's consumer landscape, it's sort of amazing, at least to me, that the little white string has survived all this time on the animal crackers package. Not only that, but it's still 100% cotton, I'm happy to report.
You've also done some inconspicuous consumption criticism of a couple of strange flavors of Australian lifesavers. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, Australia, and as is the case with many foreign countries, a lot of the flavors, not only for candies, but for other types of products, are different than the flavor profiles we see here in America. One of the more infamous Australian candy flavors is musk-flavored lifesavers. And the whole notion, aside from whether you think musk is a pleasant flavor or not, the whole notion of musk as a flavor to begin with is sort of interesting because we think of it more as a scent or an odor, perhaps, would be the better word. But in Australia, they do have musk-flavored lifesavers. They also have thirst-flavored lifesavers, which is an even more interesting concept. So here we're not using something that we think of as a smell and calling it a taste or a flavor. We're taking an abstract condition, the condition of thirst, and calling that a flavor.
Now, did you take a thirst lifesaver because you're thirsty to deal with thirst, or is it supposed to...
Or does it make you thirsty? Right, yeah. That's the question, right? After tasting one, I certainly did run for a glass of water. I'm not sure if it was so much because I was thirsty or if I just had to wash the taste out of my mouth, but it did sort of have that thirsty effect, if you want to think of it that way. Mm-hmm. But I love the notion of this abstract condition as a flavor. I mean, we could have, you know, boredom-flavored lifesavers or anger-flavored lifesavers or, you know, cantankerousness-flavored lifesavers. Any abstract condition, if we can have thirst, it seems to me we could sort of distill the essence of any abstract condition into a flavor. And I imagine those flavor chemists are getting right on that as we speak.
So tell me, Paul, what does a thirst lifesaver taste like?
I would say it's sort of like kind of a hard candy version of Gatorade, which, when you think of it, is sort of like a hard candy version of sweat, which isn't the best flavor profile you'd want to have. But that's the closest approximation of it I could come up with.
Go back to the title, Inconspicuous Consumption. All of these things are fascinating, and some of them are funny, and some of them just sort of surprising. Mm-hmm. And are you trying to offer social commentary about consumerism in doing this?
Certainly there's commentary to be made here. I think that the main thing is that there's a lot of things we take for granted about the consumer landscape and how we interact with it. And for the most part, I think it's good to think a little harder about the choices we make. I'm not looking to critique anybody's choice per se, but I do think it's worth asking the question of why do we identify so closely with brands, for instance? We walk down the cereal aisle and we'll say, oh, there's my brand of cereal, using the personal possessive. People literally identify themselves as a Coke person or a Pepsi person, literally casting their identity with the brand. And that's an interesting phenomenon, and that's certainly been one of the more interesting aspects of this project in the years I've been writing about consumerism, is that people take these things very, very personally. The relationship between people and the products they buy and the brands they identify with is an intensely personal one, but a lot of times it's sort of quietly personal or implicitly personal. It's not something they think too much about. It just builds up over time. And I do think, while I may not be able to provide the answers, and I'm not really trying to provide answers, I do think there are a lot of good questions worth considering.
Paul Lucas is the author of Inconspicuous Consumption, an obsessive look at the stuff we take for granted, from the everyday to the obscure.
Is that you? Is that you, Gus? Pete always asked twice. It was the voice of Charlie Brannock. He made the Brannock device. He'd call me every Sunday, 'cause he worked the whole week through. Well, if not for doing business, just what would Charlie do? But I soon did learn to appreciate he was the first to pay the price. He made no compromises. He made the Brannock device. As far as I'm concerned, your wit was wrong, no dice. He's got thousands of survivors, each one a Brannock device.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a cassette copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for the program number 1027B, Conspicuous Consumption. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strainchamps, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Marv Nunn, Stephen Cologne, and Carell Wheeler.
PRI, Public Radio International.